Looking for an interesting podcast? Well, stand by as I talk with the top cop, Gary Raymond.
Today I'm speaking with retired Chief Inspector of Police, Gary Raymond. In the New South Wales Police Force, Gary was involved with investigating some of Sydney's major crimes. Gary, today I'm just going to ask you, have you ever been threatened by a weapon in your years of service in the police force?
Yeah, I have actually, quite a number of times. I remember being threatened with a firearm, a pistol and a rifle. I'm being threatened with a machete and knives, baseball bats, iron bars, pinch bars, all sorts of things. That people will grab anything and everything if they want to have a go at you, that's for sure. But some of the most scariest times really is with firearms, I think, because they're so lethal. And one particular job I remember, I was working with another detective and we were doing plainclothes work. We were doing some observations and on a certain gang of individuals, and they'd been doing a lot of break-and-enters into houses and factories, and we had to stop them. But so I was working with another police officer, and we'd had actually hired a car from a car yard and to use, which looked nothing like a police car at all. It was a bit of an old bomb, really, and we had the portable radio in the glove box, and we were armed. But when you're doing that, so we had jeans and old shirts, and we were unshaven, and the hair was all over the place. We looked like crooks ourselves, actually, by the time we'd finished. And our police revolver, we put on an ankle holster. And as the term suggests, it's a holster which goes around your ankle, and the gun goes in it, of course, and then it's hidden under your jeans. And, of course, the idea is that, you know, you don't display a gun around your waist or anywhere but your arm in case you need it. So we were doing observations and following people around and just generally trying to work out who were the members of the gang. And it was quite routine, really, and it was sometimes a bit of a drag because you might sit off a place for hours and hours without any activity, and suddenly there's activity and you've got to stay hidden because if they see you, you get burnt. Although on some occasions we actually used that as a strategy. We'd be make sure that the crooks saw us, and we'd hold a set of binoculars up or something like that and be closer than we normally would be. And they'd say, oh, look out, we've been watched by, you know, undercover cops, they used to call us. We weren't really undercover, we were just doing surveillance in our plain clothes. And that would actually prevent crime because they thought, well, they're onto us, we better not commit offences today because we'll get arrested. So it works both ways. Well, we were this particular day doing some observations on an old house, waiting for activity, and a call came over our police radio. As I mentioned, we had a portable in the glove box, and the request was any police car in the vicinity of, and gave this particular address, there's a lady there been under threat from a bike gang, and she's terrified that they're going to come and get her. They've just threatened to get her, and because she used to go out with a bikie and in one of the gangs and got a lot of secrets, and they were really obviously concerned when they broke up and she left the gang. And I turned to my mate and I said, that's just round the corner. What about we go around there and protect her until the uniform on police and detectives turn up? And he said, oh, absolutely. So we called on the radio and, you know, gave him our call sign and said, look, we're just around the corner, we'll go and hold, you know, protect the witness, inverted commas, until somebody else comes. So we did a U-ey and went around the corner and stopped outside the house, and we got out of the car and walked up the driveway, and I knocked on the door, and I had the wire door open, and my mate was there with me. Next minute, I absolutely got the shock of my life. I can't describe what this did to me. The front door opened, and this lady there, with a terrified look on her face, pointed a loaded, high-powered rifle at us. And I looked, and it just takes you a while to process what you're seeing. And you're wondering what to say or what not to say, what to do. There's a temptation to grab the gun or try and push it away, but we were too far from her at that stage. It was a couple of feet. And again, I quickly calculated that if I put my hands up in the surrender gesture, which I did, I put my hands up openly like, and I said, look, don't shoot. I said, we're police officers. Well, she said, don't BS, I'm going to kill you before you kill me. You know, and I said, no, we're cops, we're really cops. And I thought if I grab the barrel of the gun and pull it, a finger was on the trigger. So if I pull the gun, it's going to pull her finger on the trigger and the gun will go off straight in the middle of my chest. And I thought, can I knock the gun out of the way? I couldn't get close enough. And I thought, can I suddenly dive down and tackle her? And I thought, well, if the gun goes off, my mate's going to get shot. And he was there, petrified as well, and we had our hands up and on, saying to her, ma'am, don't shoot. We're police. We're detectives. Don't shoot. And I said, I can show you my ID. My badge, it's in my pocket. And she said, don't, or I'll kill you. Don't you, you know. And I'm saying, don't, look, don't shoot. I said, look, I'll turn around and you can get my badge. It's in my wallet. Get it out of my back pocket and have a look at it. She said, I don't believe you. That'll be a false badge. And she's swearing and cursing. You could see she's glazed eyes. She's in an absolute panic. And I just said, oh, look, take your finger off the trigger for a minute. Don't do it. Oh, I'm going to kill you. You're not going to get me. I'm going to kill you before you kill me. And I said, we're police officers, please. And you know what? At this stage, Vince,
yeah,
I thought that I was going to die.
Mm.
And I thought, she'll shoot me, and then maybe my partner can then either wrestle her or... And I couldn't go for my gun because it's in my ankle holster. And I've got to literally kneel down or bend down or squat down to get it out or lift my leg up. And if I do that, she's going to shoot us for sure. And I'm trying to calm her down. I'm staying calm and I kept saying, we're detectives, we're police. And she didn't believe us. And I thought, you know what ran through my mind? I thought, look, I know I'm a Christian, and it goes so fast through your mind. Your life doesn't go before you, but you certainly thoughts about dying does.
Mm.
The first thing I thought of is, it's just going to hurt me when the bullet thunders into my chest. It's just going to hurt me. Am I going to just go dizzy and die, or am I going to just ride around and in pain and till I bleed to death? And I'm thinking through the physical aspects of being shot. And then I was thinking, you know, I'll never see Michelle again, or what? I'll never be able to do the things I want to do. It's all flashing through. And then I thought, well, as a Christian, I know that because I've come to Jesus and made him my Lord and Saviour, I've told him I've sinned against him. I've told him that I need forgiveness, which he's already done when he died on the cross. He paid the price and the penalty for me. And so I knew I was ready to meet God. But you know what hit me? I know we're going to die sometime. And if we don't, it's the rapture of the church may occur first, or, you know, when Jesus returns. And so I felt safe that I knew where I was going, but I thought this is not the right time. You know, why am I going to die now? And I'm talking all the time saying, don't shoot. Please don't shoot. We're police officers. Now, she was a lady from Eastern Europe. And as I was begging for my life and my partner's life, he didn't say anything. He was just had his hands up like me and just literally trying to work out how we both get out of this. As she was screaming at us and threatening us, I looked over her shoulder. Down the hallway on the back wall was a sort of a model of Christ on the cross. And as I looked over his shoulder and saw that on the wall, a real peace came over me, a real peace. And I calmed right down, and we're talking seconds here, really. And I just said to her, and I got my hands up and said, "Ma'am, I notice that you've got, you know, Jesus on the back wall on the cross. I want to tell you now that I'm a Christian police officer. And if you kill me, I know that I'll be with Jesus in an instant." And I said, "'Cause I love him, come to him and receive forgiveness from him, and I've been living my life for him. And so I want to tell you that Jesus loves you, and I love you, and I forgive you." Well, there was this, like, frozen in time moment. I'll never forget it. I'm even getting a bit emotional now thinking about it. And she stared at me, just stared at me and stared at me. And next minute, she put the gun down and had hold of it by the barrel and handed it to me. I got the gun by the barrel and I passed it behind me to my mate. And then I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, the bikies might be turning up here. And here we are, standing on the front step of this house, at the front door, and she was going to shoot me in the chest, and these blokes might come past and start, you know, riddling the place with bullets, and I'll get hit in the back. So I got a bit assertive. I said, "Look, come inside now, come inside." And I escorted her in down the hallway into the lounge room. I said, "Look, get down on the floor. Just get face down behind something, you know," and I said, "Stay there." And I got down too, and my mate came in by that time and unloaded the gun, which was loaded, by the way. And we were looking out through the window, just waiting for something to happen. And she started crying uncontrollably, And I said, "Look, just settle down. You're safe. We're here. You're safe." And she just felt the fear of the moment as we were, and our guns out now, waiting for something to happen. Well, we heard sirens in the background, and I knew that there was the police on the way to the house. And I crawled over, I got down, crawled over to her on the floor, and I said, "God was with us today." I said, "The Holy Spirit was present. His presence is known because of the miracle that's happened here today." And she said, "I love Jesus, I love Jesus, and my life's a mess." And I said, "Well, I'm going to pray with you," which I prayed with her. And I kept the lookout at the same time. And then a short time later, quite a number of police cars turned up at the address and came in. Well, you know, I made her a cup of tea then. We went into the kitchen while the other police officers were just talking to her, getting some details of what the threat was. And I made a cup of tea and we sat down with her, and she was shaking like a leaf. And to be really frank, I was too. Mm. I'm still shaking like a leaf because my body chemistry was just so running around in my body after a threat to kill me. And I was just so grateful that God had intervened in the name of Jesus at that time. And it was just the mention of his name that showed her that we were who we said we were. And I guess the funny part about this is, I always say to people, when was the last time you made a cup of tea for the person who wanted to kill you?
Yeah.
And we had a little word before, and she said that she was going into witness protection for a while. Then the detectives were there negotiating the details of that. And so off she went under their care. And I heard later that she was going really well. She'd had to get a new identity and live in a new place under the program, the witness protection program. And she started going to church again. She was a member of an Orthodox church, and was doing really well. She was getting over a traumatization, and I guess I did too, but it took me a while to get over that.
Was she charged with pointing the gun at you?
Yeah, we did. We charged her with what we call an indictable assault, pointing the gun at us. But, of course, we knew that the magistrate would have seen that it was under duress, and he dismissed it. You know, offence proved, but no conviction recorded for her. And so it was one of those things that the discretion of the court was good. And but certainly, from time to time, too, a few weeks after that, a couple of things I was extremely wary about knocking on doors, front doors. I used to knock on a door and then duck to the side, even if it was a routine inquiry, and because my brain said, be careful, the person who answered the door might be armed. Also, you know, I had some dreams and nightmares about getting shot, and it was quite weird too, because one of them, I got shot, and I went home, and I said goodbye to Michelle, my wife, and then dropped dead on the floor. But
another dramatic dream.
Yeah, well, they're all just mixed up memories, dreams. Mm. There's nothing to be ever, you know, considered real with them at all. So, yeah, so that was an interesting one for sure. Another one too was when I was working in Cabramatta, which is a southwestern suburb of Sydney. And it was a very bad area for heroin dealing, and there was murders there and prostitutes and gangs, the Vietnamese 5T gang and others were running the place, and there was extortion of businesses and shop owners, and it was just dreadful. And so we did our best with the numbers of police that we had, and thankfully later we started Operation Pacini with a number of extra police and some CCTV in a control room, and it helped us a great deal to then get it under control. But one day I was patrolling with another police officer, and we're around the southern part of Cabramatta. We heard what appeared to be either fireworks, and it's not unusual for being in the Asian community that they would let fireworks off, not supposed to, but for various celebrations like weddings and funerals and New Year and you know, the Chinese New Year, all the rest of it, they used to. And we heard this bang, bang, bang. And I looked at my mate and she said, are you thinking what I'm thinking? I said, absolutely, that's not crackers. They're not fireworks, that's gun. So we went down the back of a block of units and round into the street. And we saw people hitting the ground and screaming. There were elderly women and a few children and some people who were just walking on the street. And I looked up, and out of the window of this block of flats, I saw the end of a rifle, the rifle barrel. And next minute, bang, bang, you know, two more shots across the road. And I looked across the road, and we knew that there was a block of units, but in this particular unit, we'd been told there was some gambling taking place. It was like a, illegal gambling den sort of thing.
Yep.
So the first thing, you know, we got our guns out, but we couldn't see the person. We just saw the gun barrel sticking out of the window. And I immediately thought, next minute, he's going to start shooting people in the street. And my partner and I were behind a brick wall at this stage, a brick fence sort of thing. And I looked at these people, and they were screaming and trying to crawl to cover. And the first thing I thought of, well, first thing is, we called on the radio for urgent assistance. And I thought, I've got to evacuate these people. And I thought, if they stand up, this gunman will start shooting them. So I looked, and there was a big drain, this big stormwater drain, which went down beside the units and went under the roadway. And it's a large drain. And so I yelled at people, and I said to my partner, I said to her, let's get these people through the drain out the other side. We've got no other choice. And she said, right. So we were yelling at them to crawl sort of behind the brick fence, brick wall, towards us. And I said to them, follow me. And so we're crawling on the grass and then across the sort of a pathway down this slope. And it was a gentle slope going into this drain. And people are saying, I don't want to go in there. I said, follow me now. Come on. Let's get in here. you've got to do this. The next minute, another two shots went off, not in our direction, but across the road again. And I thought for a second, has he seen us or not? And I wasn't taking any chances. So there was about half a dozen people. And I crawled into the drain and I yelled out to them, stay on your tummy and follow me quickly, really quickly. And I said to my partner, I said, you stay behind and get behind the last person, push him in, get him in behind me, and then you follow through. So as I went in, there was about an inch or two of water in the drain, and we're crawling through there. It was quite smelly, and that sort of stale smell. And there was a couple of rats were disturbed and ran in front of me, and a few of the people saw the rats, and they were screaming. I said, be quiet, be quiet now, shh, be quiet. So I didn't want the gunmen to be alerted that we were there. And so there was spiders' webs in there and lots of cockroaches, and I was sort of trying to shoo them up the pipe as I was crawling through. And I had a little torch, because I always carry a little torch when I'm on duty. You never know when you're going to be in the dark, inverted commas. So the people, they're crying and protesting. No, no, no. I said, come on. And my partner's really getting quite assertive with them and said, keep going. Follow Mr. Raymond. Follow the policeman. And it was quite distressing, because some people had never been in a claustrophobic environment before. Some of them had never, ever seen rats at close quarters or cockroaches or anything else that was crawling in there. And as we went through, it got darker and darker. And then as we got to a slight bend, we could see the light at the end of the tunnel, inverted commas. So they're crying, you know, and snivelling. And it's funny that some of them were really quiet, not saying a thing. They were just breathing heavily. And others were verbalising, and others were crying. And one lady screamed at one stage with seeing a rat. And we had to keep it quiet really suddenly, because we didn't want to be alerted. So we came out the other end, which ended up again behind a block of units on the other side of the road. And that way we got very adequate cover, and we made them just lie on the ground face down until I said, stay there face down until we tell you to do anything else. Stay there. And by this time, there was a massive amount of police had surrounded the block of units. A few police officers went up and knocked on the door of the unit where the gunman was. And we heard on the radio that he surrendered peacefully without incident, and the firearm had been secured. That is, they recovered the firearm and unloaded it, made it safe. And then after a while, we got everyone up on their feet. They were all wet and were upset, and I was just exhausted, not only from crawling through the drain, but just keeping everyone under control. And both of us were. We actually then with other police officers had to get their details, everyone, because we'd get statements from them later on that day. And so we called the ambulance, and the ambulance worked to check everyone out to make sure how their physical and mental health condition was after crawling through the drain. Found out later that the gunman was, his group, his gang, were owed money from this gambling den across the road, and it was his job to shoot the place up to intimidate them to pay the debt. It was a gambling debt, and quite a substantial amount, I believe. And he was charged with a number of serious offences and got jail time for it. And, of course, he brought attention to the place across the road, which the detectives got a search warrant and searched that and shut it down. And got gathering evidence there ballistically as well. So that was very, very scary. We just, the unknown, see a lot of it. But it just reminded me when I was trying to relax back at the station, and after I'd done a statement myself, and the boss said, you better get yourself home and have a change of clothes and a hot shower, and we'll see you tomorrow. And so I was just relaxing, having a coffee and with my partner talking to other police. And as they were talking, I wasn't involved in this conversation. I just thought to myself, you know, Jesus said in the book of Matthew, he said, follow me. Now, that's interesting. And I thought, okay, if he said follow me, that means he's going to go first into any situation. We don't have to go first, but he goes first. And it was just like I went into that pipe and told people to follow me through, that I would get rid of the danger and make a way through the pipe for everybody else. And it was interesting. I thought, Lord, you just reminded me that no matter what happens in my life, you've been there first. And you've been to clear the area. You've been to look at dangers along the way. You've been there to make a way for me spiritually and physically. And I thought, that's beautiful. From now on, Lord, I'm going to just think about that and follow you no matter where you lead. And it's a big trust thing. Those people trust in me to keep them safe. Now, I don't know if they were in imminent danger, because apparently the gunman didn't see us because he was sort of in the unit upstairs, but I didn't take any chances and I got them safe. And Jesus promised, he said, for those who thank me for dying on the cross, for those who thank me for, you know, preventing God's wrath on them for their sin, then you're safe. And so we've got safety by following Jesus all the way from earth to heaven, really. Safe, and, you know, it doesn't mean we're not vulnerable to things happening to us here on earth. Of course we are. It's a dangerous place on earth because it's fallen, it's corrupt, and there's a whole range of things where people disobey the rules, and then there's consequences. And so I want to say to people, if you haven't followed Jesus, you need to do it now. He can be trusted.
Have you had any other incidences where you've been in trouble with a weapon?
Yeah, look, this is a bit of a hilarious one too. We had an armed robber, which we were looking for, and we knew that his mum and dad lived at Seven Hills. So we got our surveillance units to watch the house, and because a lot of the time he'd hide for a few days and always come back home. And he had a stolen 38 Smith and Wesson revolver that he was doing the armed robberies with. He had a very bad drug habit. And so we saw him, the surveillance crew, I should say, saw him come home. And they watched him, and he went to bed. So at the police station, I was arranging a raid. And we knew he was in there, so we had justification of coming in there. But we rang the on-call chamber magistrate and got a search warrant as well, because we needed to not only arrest him, but see if we could find some evidence of his armed robbery, such as, you know, the gun, clothing. And it's interesting too that armed robbers often change their clothing, but they never change their shoes or their cap. And or they might throw all their clothes in the washing and hang it on the line. And so the clothing, especially if we get eyewitnesses or CCTV footage of the clothing. And the other thing is too, if they've got a watch, they never change their watch. And they're always wearing their watch. So if we've got a good photo or video surveillance of the particular watch, and we arrest them, they've got the same watch on, it's not too... it's pretty good evidence, particularly if they're wearing a balaclava. And the other thing is too, tattoos. And some of them bowl in there in a T-shirt with a balaclava on and gloves, but they're exhibiting their tattoos everywhere. And so we can then match from the CCTV or witnesses the tattoos. So we got the surveillance team to do some close-up work on the house. And they, you know, their leader came back to the police station, and we drew a plan, which is, you know, there's the windows here, the two doors there, there's no dogs, this fence is easily got over, the back fence is not. So they give us intelligence or information on which to do the search warrant or the raid, if you like. So we're all ready, and it was about 3 in the morning, I think, and we thought, we'll wait for a little while, we'll wait till sunrise, just before sunrise. And the advantage of that is that we can crash into the place under the cover of darkness, and then not long later the sun rises, and we can then do a more thorough search of the inside and outside of the premises. And generally, just before sunrise too, or just before dawn, people are very much fast asleep. Most of some aren't, of course, but so it's a good time to raid places for a number of reasons like that. So there we are. We get down there, and I've got a team, which we call the TRG in those days, the Tactical Response Group, or Men in Black, doing a marvellous job, and they were armed with shotguns, pump action shotguns. So at my direction, a nod of my head, we crashed into the house, and the surveillance team said that the offender is asleep in the first bedroom on your right coming into the house. So I'm following the TRG operatives, and we crashed into this bedroom with shotguns pointed. And next minute, the shock of my life, again, an embarrassment, that this dear elderly couple sat bolt right up in bed. We had high-powered torches on them, and they're wondering what's, they're sort of quivering and not screaming anything, but, and I said, please, you know, and we looked at it, and I said, oh, no. Like, I remember there was a, on each side of their bed was a glass with false teeth in, and soaking them, and there was a potty on each side of the bed, and these dear pensioners were absolutely terrified. We put the lights on so they could see that we were police officers. And what ran through my mind then was, number one, oh no, we've got the wrong house. We've busted into the wrong house. This is going to be really good for a current affair. It's going to be really good for the Commissioner of Police. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really good for any lawyer that wants to have a go at us. And I was, the colour drained from my face. But then as I was going through all these terrible consequences for me, the dear old lady, muttering with no teeth, said, oh, I think you want my son. He's in the next bedroom. So it was like the Keystone Cops. We were all nearly falling over each other, backing out of there. And we teared down the hallway and crashed into the next bedroom on the right. And there was this armed robber offender, absolutely and utterly asleep. He was dead to the world, as it were. And so the TRG immediately, we dragged the bedclothes off him, grabbed his ankles, and dragged him off the bed onto the floor. And we then handcuffed him and searched him. As we're searching the bedroom, I lifted up the pillow in which he was asleep on. Under the pillow was a loaded 38 Smith & Wesson revolver. And the colour drained from my face because, in a way, thankfully, he had had a lot of drugs the day before and half the night, and it had knocked him out. Had he been not drugged out and fast asleep, and we went into the wrong bedroom, goodness knows what we're going to find when we went into his bedroom. It could have been tragic for a lot of us. It would have been a shootout, I'm sure. And he said that later. He said he wasn't going to be taken alive. And so, again, the look of that gun under that pillow, fully loaded, and what the consequences of us could have been with that one simple mistake, going into the wrong bedroom. And again, it makes you realise how dangerous police work can do, how accurate you've got to do your planning, your risk management, how amazingly blessed we were to get out of that one, including the offender himself. I'm sure that if he'd have fired shots at police, they would have opened up with shotguns, and it would not have been very pretty for him, I'm sure.
No, that's right.
But thank God we were saved from a shootout where no one got injured, and he was arrested and charged with about 7 armed robberies, I believe, by the detectives who were working on his case. And he did lengthy time in jail. We got a carpenter in to fix the front door, and put a new door on there for the sterile couple. And I said, oh, they're going to complain about all this drama. And I had a cup of tea with them. And I apologised. And look, I'm really sorry for the anguish and fear that we put through. You put you all through. You both through. And you know what? The elderly man said to me, he said, thank God that you arrested our son. Don't worry about frightening us. We're calm now because he's in custody. We've been worried about him killing someone or him getting killed or a shootout with the police, and we just didn't know what to do. He threatened us a number of times that if we called the police or opened our mouths, he'd kill us. And she said, thank you for breaking down my front door. Thank you for busting into my door and pointing a shotgun at me. And so I thought, well, you know, people thanking you for busting into their place and pointing firearms at them. But, and so, and a lot of friends and relatives are like that, where when an offender that they know is running wild on drugs or other crime gets arrested and puts into custody, there's a real peace comes over the place, knowing that they're now off the streets, as we term it, and doing a jail sentence where, who knows, hopefully they can rehabilitate. Some do and some don't. And some find jail a very much college of crime where they learn to do more things, and others reform totally and get out of jail and never commit another offence, that's for sure. And so, yeah, that was another very scary one and some very anxious moments, I can assure you. And it would not have looked pretty if we'd gone into the wrong house.
Definitely not.
Yeah, and I had some, let's say, interesting firm words with the surveillance team who got it wrong. And I said, well, look, don't worry about it. I said, you know, you'll learn, every lesson's learned. And I said, we got the offender. No one was injured. And so that was a good outcome. But, yeah, so that was another scary one, that's for sure. Yeah, well, they're the incidents that sort of I can relate about firearms anyway, and I just want to publicly praise God for getting me through all incidents concerning weapons. Some police officers aren't so fortunate. They don't get to go home, and their families have lost their loved one forever in that situation. And you know, we just want to say thank you to all the serving police officers out there now. Thank you to the retired and former police officers. And I include, too, the Australian Federal Police and Border Force and all of those engaged in law enforcement and the risks that we take. And we want to just praise God and thank him for his protection.
Thank you for speaking to us today, Gary. I've been speaking with retired Chief Inspector of Police, Gary Raymond, and looking forward to catching up again, Gary.
We will. Thanks, Vince, and thank you to those listening.